Hello and welcome to Korean Context, a behind-the-scenes conversation with the scholars, artists, and opinion makers who bridge our two worlds. This podcast was brought to you by the Korea Economic Institute in Washington, D.C. I'm Martha Legutsky, and I'll be your host today. In this episode, we speak with Mr. Ken E. Gause, currently a senior research analyst with the International Affairs Group and Iranian Studies Program at CNA Strategic Studies. In our conversation, we focus primarily on North Korean succession, its current state, and implications for the future. Mr. Gause has published a number of articles, book chapters, and papers on North Korean military and leadership, including North Korean Civil Military Trends, Military First Politics to a Point, which was published by the Strategic Studies Institute at the United States Army War College. Thank you so much for being here.
Glad to be here.
We are going to talk today primarily about succession and the current leadership regime in North Korea, which is a hot topic these days, to say the least. How positive are we that the next leader of North Korea will be Kim Jong-il's third son, Kim Jong-un?
Well, the decision seems to have been made. The recent party conference seems to indicate that the third son is the chosen successor. He has been essentially named by various elements within the North Korean leadership as being the successor. Now, that being said, we are probably in the second phase of a three-phase succession process, and that phase begins when the successor's name is made public, which it was made back at the party conference. Now it really is incumbent upon Kim and his son to build a consensus within the leadership around the son in order to ensure that the succession will go smoothly. And I would say right now there is, while the succession seems to be apace, there is no guarantee that it cannot be thrown off kilter.
Now I'd like to ask you about Jang Song-taek, who's actually the brother-in-law of Kim Jong-il, and as I understand it, is playing a pretty serious role in the planning of succession and the implementation of succession. And actually, some have said that he may even act as regent once Kim Jong-il passes away.
Well, there was no question, in my mind at least, that coming out of this the lead-up to the party conference and the party conference, that there was essentially three institutions that are rings of power that are being built around the succession. And if you look at when the appointments were made leading into the succession, leading into the party conference and the party conference itself, the day before the party conference, you had the military promotions. And the first two military promotions were of Kim's sister, Kim Jong-hui, as well as his son Kim Jong-un being promoted to four-star generals. Then you had a series of very senior military promotions, and then the next day you had the promotions and appointments to the party apparatus, which would suggest that the three circles that are exist around the succession, that is looking to guarantee the succession, is first the Kim family, mainly centered on Kim's sister, Kim Jong-hui, and her husband, Jang Song-taek. And then after that, the military, and then the party apparatus. So in terms of the family, they have been playing a very important role, I think, in guaranteeing the succession, trying to build up consensus within the regime around the succession. Jang Song-taek reappeared after being for want of a better word, purged from the leadership in 2004, made a return in 2006, and then in 2007, '08, '09, he started to play a much more influential role in the day-to-day running of the regime. Kim's sister, Kim Jong-hui, returned around in 2009, and started to see her on a lot of guidance inspections. And both of these people have very extensive ties throughout the leadership, the party, the military, the state apparatus within the leadership, and will play, in my opinion, a very important role as we go forward with the succession. Now, that said, there is no guarantee in many Pyongyang watchers' mind that that Jang Song-taek and his wife will continue to support the third son after we move on to after Kim either becomes incapacitated or dies. There is a belief within many people in the Pyongyang watching community that that Chung Sung-tae and probably Kim Kyung-hui had to be convinced to support the third son. They had strong ties to the first son, Kim Jong-nam. Yeah. And we believe that, or at least many Pyongyang watchers believe that that process of winning over the family in support of the selection of the third son probably happened sometime in 2009, 2010, as we started to see Chung Sung-tae move up within the National Defense Commission apparatus, and of course Kim Kyung-hui becoming much more, taking a much more high profile position within the leadership.
So in 2004, Chung Sung-tae was actually, as you said, purged from the leadership system, as I understand it, because he might have been gaining too much power among the leadership. And I don't know if you've taken a look at the recent WikiLeaks, all the hubbub that's emerged in the past couple of days, but there's new information that's been leaked from that source that says that actually a number of Korea watchers expect some contention between Kim Jong-un and Chung Sung-tae after Kim Jong-il is actually incapacitated.
Well, that is, again, that is something that a lot of the Pyongyang watchers have been speculating on, is how much support does Chung Sung-tae really have, or how much does he really actually support the third son, and Kim Jong-hui for that matter. As I said, that there have been long rumored stories that both of them are fairly close to the first son, that they really did not support the third son's rise. And if you look at the propaganda and the internal propaganda within North Korea, really going back to the 2003-2002 period through the 2004 period, when you started to have the build-up of the idolization campaign around Ko Hyung-hui, who was the mother of the third son, Kim Jong-un, at that period, you started to see the tension start to rise within the regime, apparently between forces that supported Ko Hyung-hui and her faction, supposedly supported by Yi Chi-kang, who was Chung Sung-tae's primary rival within the leadership, and Chung Sung-tae and his, essentially, group of people who were rising within the leadership as well. They were both at this time within the Organization Guidance Department, which is the most powerful department, the oversight department within the party apparatus for making sure, ensuring stability within the party and the regime apparatus around the Kim family. In 2004, there are a variety of rumors of why Chung Sung-tae may have been purged. Some rumors are that he was pushing back against economic reforms that were going on, that were being pushed by the premier at that time, Park Pung-chu. Others, rumors is that he got crosswise with Kim over the succession process, and that Kim became concerned that Chung Sung-tae was developing a powerful network of individuals that owed their loyalty to Chung Sung-tae, and that could conceivably upset Kim's succession plans, which were aimed at one of the two sons of Ko Hyung-hui at that time. It's interesting to note that Chung Sung-tae started to reemerge after this purging or put under house arrest or disappearance from the center of the leadership. Sometime around 2006, Ko Hyung-hui had died in around 2004, and we started to see the reemergence as her idolization campaign disappeared in terms of the rhetoric within the North Korean media surrounding her started to disappear. That is about the time that Chung Sung-tae started to reappear. So there seems to be this kind of natural tension between Chung Sung-tae and the sons of Kim's fourth wife or mistress at that time, Ko Hyung-hui, and it's only once that she was out of the way that Kim started to look to bringing his family back into the center, and then trying to, I believe, made a deal with Chung Sung-tae, saying that he would allow him to build his network of people as long as he supported Kim's choice for successor. That's what I believe, the deal that was made. Whether Chung Sung-tae is going to support that deal after Kim dies is anybody's guess.
Mm-hmm. Now, about Kim Jong-un, a number of concerns have been raised about his ability to lead just from sheer lack of experience. Do you know anything about what we can expect from him as a leader?
Well, as I said, we are currently probably in the second phase of succession. If we use the Kim Jong-il model as the model for succession, there are about three phases of succession. The first phase is a phase in which a successor is designated, and then you probably had the beginnings of an on-the-job training of what it means to be the leader. And what this means is that the successor would be given situational awareness of certain parts of the regime. He would receive certain reporting lines from the military, the party, the state apparatus. He would be able to have a certain amount of understanding of how decision making works. We're, as I said, now in the second phase, most likely the second phase of this succession, which means that the heir apparent has been designated. The reporting lines going to the successor or the heir apparent now have become more robust, and we are in a situation of what we call a limited duopoly of power, where Kim Jong-il is the primary decision maker, and Kim Jong-un is essentially learning on the job on how to do the guidance inspections, how to make decisions on certain issues within the certain boundaries set down by his father. The idea is, as we transition to a third phase, that Kim Jong-il will take a back seat, and that the younger son or the heir apparent will take much more of a role in the running the day-to-day affairs in the regime. This would have been about, in terms of Kim Jong-il's own succession, probably in the period of the early 80s, and as we transition to the 90s, that would be the transition to the third phase. And as you can see, Kim Jong-il was designated as a successor internally to the regime around 1973-74. He wasn't made public in moving into the second phase probably till about 1980, and then around the early 90s we moved into, or mid-80s to the early 90s is when we moved into the third phase. That is a long period of time that it seems to be being truncated in this case, and it means that that the young son is going to have to learn very quickly. In this second phase, there's also something else that starts to take place, is the young son, or the heir apparent, has to start to prove himself as a legitimate successor within the eyes of the wider leadership in North Korea. That's a consensus-building phase, in other words, in which presumably people such as Chung Son-taek and Kim Kyung-hui would be involved in this building of consensus. But part of the consensus building is also showing some sort of successes that shows that you are capable of carrying off very prudent and insightful decision-making that leads to success for the regime. Soon after we presume that the decision was made to go with Kim Jong-un in the early, around 2009, you had the beginnings of I think what they tried to do was to look toward the economy as the area where the successor would show the successes. You had the 100 and the 150-day campaigns, which are these Kalima or speed campaigns that are very reminiscent of the ones that Kim Jong-il conducted in the 1970s. And the idea is to show rapid success in the economy. And this, I think, led up to the currency revaluation November 2009. And I think ultimately what happened is that the attempts to show success and build up the bona fides of the young son within the economy was an unmitigated disaster.
Right.
And so the other area where you can tend to build up bona fides and show success is within the military realm, within the national security realm. And I think that the Chenan incident was an attempt to try to get the succession process, which had been thrown off kilter by the currency revaluation, back on kilter. And I think the recent shellings at the Yongbyon was a way of showing the military bona fides of the young son, which tend to be tied to the North Korean artillery and missile forces. So I think that it's not a by coincidence that the recent shelling was an artillery versus some other means of military provocation.
So are you saying that those sort of provocations are more symbolic than they are threatening to?
Well, they're threatening. And the problem is, and this leads to another problem that you have when you have a succession going on in a place like North Korea, is that it can skew all manner of decision-making within the regime in terms of national security policy, foreign policy, domestic policy. Everything is seen through the lens of the succession and how it will impact the succession. And so therefore what you do is you tend to exacerbate the already problematic tendency of North Korean decision-making, which is a very tactical-based, near-term decision-making as opposed to long-term, looking toward long-term goals, such as in North Korea's point of view. I think the long-term goal still is finding some sort of accommodation, security accommodation with the United States, finding something that's going to give North Korea a certain amount of security guarantees as well as international aid. But yet, the decision-making they're having to do supporting the succession with all of these provocations is essentially undermining those larger strategic goals that they're going through. And so this can be, while it may seem symbolic to a certain sense, it's based on the idea of building internal support within the regime around the succession, which may not necessarily be what the regime needs to be doing to promote its own interests internally and externally.
So in a sense, possibly taking a step back from the perspective of the regime before it can try to move forward with a new leader.
And it could actually end up, causing very dramatic setback for their larger term goals as we move past a Kim Jong-il leadership into the next leadership configuration, in which this regime will be possibly even more isolated than the current regime is and lack less tools to be able to reach out, to be able to, in terms of its own interest, internally and externally.
As an analyst, what signs would you consider to be warnings that a country is headed toward some form of failure? And does North Korea exhibit any of those signs?
Yes and no. I think that it depends on what type of instability you're talking about within the leadership. If you're talking about leadership within the elite ranks or the leadership ranks, a crisis of leadership, and a crisis within the elite. Basically, the types of indicators that you're going to start to see are purges going on within the close aid networks around Kim. Other people being brought in who are supposedly closer to the young son or maybe to Chung Sun-taek or other elements within the leadership. You're going to start seeing things that are built around trying to build consensus, but maybe having problems in building consensus in terms of these purges that could be going on. If it is a crisis in terms of state, the ability of the regime to be able to provide for the public, then what you're going to see are things probably reminiscent of what we saw in the 1990s. The proliferation of the markets to fill in the gaps left bare by the inability of their public distribution networks to work. You could possibly see, even if it goes beyond that and becomes exacerbated, riots centered on the markets, as well as the ordinary North Korean citizens losing, becoming much more mobile within the regime in search for food and resources. If this gets extrapolated out to the worst case scenario, what you could possibly see are warlord networks being set up around the country, around certain reservoirs of resources in the country. And if that gets attached to various military units within the country that are trying to protect resources within their own spheres of influence and their own territories, then what you could do is you could start to see the splitting apart of various patronage networks and various Praetorian Guard networks into individual units that are in competition to each other. One of the interesting things about the way that Kim Jong-il runs the regime that's very different than his father, Kim Il-sung, ran it, is that he has created a system that is essentially in competition with itself. He keeps various elements of the regime competing with other elements to keep them essentially off balance and from forming networks that would oppose his own his own power. So what you have is competition within the regime for influence with Kim. And Kim has become the linchpin of all of these networks. Now, once you remove that linchpin, then you have the potential for all these competition for influence to turn into competition for power, which means power struggles amongst factions. Now, I think one of the things that the party conference tried to do was to try to take a lot of these networks and place it within the party apparatus to give it a much more formalized structure that would allow the system and allow China, I think, to have some sort of influence to keep these power networks separated and keep them from going at each other. I think that may have been one of the things that China was hoping to get out of this, whether it's something that Kim Jong-il's own planning, I'm not exactly sure. But I think that part of this party conference was to try to give an institutionalized structure that would make the succession process go much more smoothly. Now, whether we have seen any indications of instability so far, I think that there have been some indications of obviously the distribution network, the public distribution networks not working, even though they were reinstituted around 2007. We have seen, you know, some indications, some rumors that there have been some trouble around the markets as the North Korean regime is trying to clamp down on the markets in order to smooth the succession, because part of the playbook for succession is that you have a centralized economy. And so they want to kind of clamp down on the markets, one, to reinstitutionalize state control over the economy, which was lost during the 1990s. And I don't think they've been very successful at that. And they've had to actually draw back on that and let some of the markets exist to a much more robust level than they, I think, originally intended. Another thing where you tend to have seen problems is that they fear that the markets will be an area where information from the outside world can be proliferated within the regime, and that they have tried to crack down on that, and I don't know if they've been that successful. But to say that we've seen clear indications of instability inside North Korea, yet at this point, I don't think so. That doesn't mean it can't happen. And it doesn't mean that all these provocations that are being conducted could lead to something of instability within the regime, but I don't think that we've seen it so far. So I believe that if the succession were to take place in the near term, that probably North Korea could muddle through. The question is whether you're going to have a crisis of leadership at the top. In other words, that Kim Jong-un hasn't been able to consolidate his power by then, and that you have a full-blown power struggle between elements of the leadership that could lead to weakening at the top, that could cause instability and cracking within the regime.
Does anybody outside of North Korea have real influence over North Korea and its government? Some say that, you know, China is our best bet. Others have serious doubts about that.
Yeah, my own sense is that China has probably the best visibility inside North Korea, but in terms of their influence, it's still very limited. I think that one of the reasons for the party conference, I think that China was pushing for North Korea to revitalize the party apparatus, which had been allowed to atrophy under Kim Jong-il. I think that China has a view and a hope that this will allow them to have a little bit more influence in the future. Some people believe that people such as Chung Sun-taek are fairly close to China, and that's where China is essentially putting their eggs in that basket. That Chung Sun-taek will be their guy on the inside who will ensure that their equities are respected. That being said, I am very dubious about the North Korean leadership, which is a very nationalistic, the people in North Korea, very nationalistic to begin with, are very nervous about being beholden to China, completely beholden to China. I am very dubious about the fact that China will have a lot of influence in the future, at least as far as what we can tell right now. So as far as anybody being able to tell the North Koreans what they're going to do and force them to do it, I just don't think that country exists.
How much truth would you say there is in the suggestion that North Korea is actually using China as a pawn of sorts, either for aid or...
Well, North Korea recognizes certain red lines. And that's red lines against South Korea and the United States in terms of what they can do in terms of provocations. And I think they have in their mind certain red lines about how far China can be pushed in terms of supporting North Korea in whatever endeavors it's going to do. I wouldn't say that they use China as a pawn, but they believe, I think the North Korean has its own view of how far they can push China before China will start to really restrict the types of resources that would ensure stability within the regime. And I think that North Korea realizes that China is very reluctant to do anything that they believe would destabilize the regime in North Korea. And that's the trump card that North Korea has.
Well, this is probably an unfair question, but do you have any sense of the time frame, you know, in the next 5-10 years, what we can expect from North Korea?
5 to 10 years?
Will it take that long? I mean, do we expect North Korea to survive beyond this succession?
My own point of view is that it will survive this succession. How long it will survive is the question. I believe that it will muddle through. And I think a lot of China's calculations on North Korea is being based on what follows Kim Jong-il. If they get a sense that the new regime will undertake some of the reforms that China has been pushing, that will take China's guidance much more seriously than the Kim Jong-il leadership did, I think that China will continue to support the regime, and I think that it will, because of that support, unless there is internal instability in North Korea itself, which is a fairly significant possibility. But if they don't have that, I think that they will be able to muddle through. I think the connective tissue in this regime still exists long enough to help them muddle through the succession. Now, if North Korea starts to undertake serious economic reform, and I think that they have been serious in the past about trying to approach economic reform, but they have always run up against issues of internal security in the regime. If this regime is pushed by China or believes that it has to take on internal economic reform, that could cause an unraveling of the regime that leads to an ultimate collapse. And of course, there are a lot of other things that could go wrong. As I said, internal stability in this regime. And also, if China doesn't believe that this regime is going to change much, I think at that point, China might start reassessing its own relationship with North Korea. And that could have a potentially destabilizing impact.
Because it's an expensive relationship, both politically and financially.
But I think from at least if we take China's point of view, or at least the people that I've talked in China, the alternative could be even more expensive in terms of a calamity on their border, in terms of refugee flows, in terms of a humanitarian crisis, in terms of a possible civil war, in terms of a possible war on the peninsula. Supporting the North Korean regime may be the least of worst alternatives that they're facing.
So one final question. You mentioned the three large players in the North Korean leadership. There's the Kim family, the military, and the party itself. What sort of dynamic do those three parts have now?
Well, it is shifted from the period of Kim Il-sung to the period of Kim Jong-il, and it has even begun to shift under Kim Jong-il. Under Kim Il-sung, you essentially had a networking of these various organizations, with the party being the lead agent that essentially set the agenda for the regime. Under Kim Jong-il and the military first policy, what you had is the beginning of essentially creating lanes of responsibility for the party in the state and the military apparatus. And this was an idea of trying to get the party out of the economy and allow the cabinet to have the much more control over the running of the economy. And this was what led to the 2001 July economic measures and some of the reforms that were taken in that realm. The military also as seen as the one entity within the regime that could be counted on to carry out significant change within the regime if need be, or to promote economic stability, those sorts of things. The military was given, obviously, a role in addition to its role for guaranteeing security, which was the preeminent role of all of the entities within the party, or within the country. In most recent years, though, what we have started to see is the growth of the party again, and highlighted by, obviously, the party conference, where a lot of the party is being reinvigorated. And so we're starting to see a return to the way, at least in the very broad framework, the way that the regime may have been run or was run under the Kim Il-sung period. I think what they're trying to do is put in position a formalized apparatus that the Sun can run between a kind of using the party and the military very tightly joined together in the most upper reaches of the party in order to give him some sort of control in order to run this regime. I think that where you see the Young Sun's primary position is the vice chairman of the Central Military Committee, a party body. And this is a body in which will allow him to build patronage systems outside of his own family, outside of Chong Son-taek and outside of Kim Jong-hui, and those patronage systems, to build patronage systems within the party and the military apparatus. And the idea, I think, here is that if he has enough time, if Kim's health holds out long enough, that the Young Sun can build up enough patronage within the system, though, that when Kim passes from the scene, he can be a player in his own right and not somebody who is just a figurehead of a variety of powerful collective leadership behind him, which will most likely be the case if Kim were to die in the near term.
Well, thank you so much for letting me pick your brain for a few minutes. Your expertise is much appreciated.
Sure.
For more information about this episode, this podcast, and upcoming KEI events, please check out our podcast page at keia.podbean.com. As always, please feel free to send any questions, comments, or suggested podcast topics to me at podcast@keia.org. I'd love to hear from you, so please don't be shy. Well, that's all for now. Thanks so much for listening. It was a pleasure to have you, and we look forward to seeing you next time on Korean Context. Bye.